selling prepackaged foodstuff. So, in addition to adding value to raw products such as meat, companies have also designed attractive packaging to contain food in more manageable portions. Such a strategy increases not only product quality, but also food safety, which helps producers meet international export standards. This trend also helps companies with branding and has created job opportunities for designers.
As you probably already know, the food industry is heavily dependent on production in the agriculture sector. So it's no surprise that the agriculture sector holds the pulse of national food security and food exports. Plus, it is one of the only sectors that has been barely impacted by the US-imposed sanctions and the global coronavirus outbreak. That was horrible.
We looked at some figures from the Ministry of Agriculture to see how this sector is doing. Last year, around 6 million tons of agricultural and foodstuff products were exported. Trade of these products raked in roughly $4 billion. Pistachio, saffron, and confectionery products topped the export charts in value during that period. Other agriculture sectors, such as livestock, poultry, and aquaculture, have also generated millions of dollars in exports. Last year, nearly 450,000 tons of these items were sent to markets in neighboring regions, worth $500 million. Agriculture accounts for 8% of the country's gross domestic product. It might be interesting to know that around half of Iran's total non-oil trade comes from this sector. That's all based on data from Iran's Ministry of Agriculture. According to Iran's Customs Administration, the total non-oil trade value rose nearly 40% last year. Over 120 million tons of non-oil products worth $72 billion were traded with other countries in that period. Meanwhile, the government has implemented measures to encourage the development of agriculture. One trend this sector is witnessing is the application of smart technologies for the cultivation and harvest of various products. There has also been a boom in developing greenhouses and green practices to preserve natural resources. The word plastic was initially used to describe pliable and easily shaped objects. However, it only recently became a name for a category of materials called polymers. Such materials are abundant in nature. Take cellulose, for example. It's the material that makes up the cell walls of plants. However, synthetic polymers are a more recent invention of the last 150 years. These come from the plentiful carbon atoms found in fossil fuels. Since then, they have become an integral part of the industry, technology, and even various sciences.
We will explore Iran's plastic and polymer productions. We will also check out some of its downstream markets and their contributions to the national economy. These days, we use more plastic than ever before. It's terrible. So where does this material come from? And what goes into making this stuff? Let's find out.
Our quest for answers led us to a company specializing in making various polymer products. Parsa Polymer Sharif was established some 20 years ago and is a knowledge-based company that was born in the research department of the University of Sharif. As a leading advanced polymer compound manufacturer, it makes various products essential to everyday living. It produces compounds based on commodity thermoplastic resins like PP, PE, and the famous PET, or PET. It also engineers resins like PVC, and so much more. This knowledge-based company is a major supplier of raw materials to many industries. Some include original equipment manufacturers in the automotive market and PVC pipe producers in the construction industry. Over the years, this company has helped Iran save millions on products that would otherwise be imported. This firm has three main functions: research and development, innovation center, and production. It also has a brand new line for researching and producing biodegradable polymers for the packaging industry. Most of the raw materials needed for production are domestically purchased. When this stuff enters the company, it is first tested and graded based on its quality. Then, according to its intended use, the raw material is formulated and sent to machines for production.
Machines used in the polymer industry utilizes some of the most advanced machinery for production. The extruder is one of the most commonly used machines. They play a central role in plastic production. Extruder lines are the largest converters of plastics worldwide. Some of these machines can be domestically manufactured while others are still imported.
Its products are all tested in its well-equipped research and development lab. The various granules and resin compounds undergo over a dozen tests while being analyzed for quality here. Also, new product formulas are created in this highly technical research and development department. Through these facilities, the company is expanding its product portfolio. Products made here are produced along the lines of exports. So, national and international quality standards are implemented during the production processes. This means the quality of products found here doesn't just match international standards, they go beyond the quality of competing foreign brands in the international arena. The headquarters of this company is located in Sharif University Advanced Technologies Incubator. Owing to this, it has strong relations and collaborations with the scientific community. It has also been awarded for its contributions to the scientific and industrial sectors over the past years. This knowledge-based company also exports its products. The company has a unique future vision strongly intertwined with sustainable business development. This is partly due to its forward-thinking and social and environmental responsibility outlook.
Now, polymers are the primary materials that build many other products. Plastic items have different polymer formulations depending on their application. The majority of polymers made in Iran are domestically consumed. Some of its biggest customers are in the construction sector. Also, plastic is extensively used in the medical industry and transportation.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. Moreover, plastic has played a central role in the development of the medical industry over the past 60 years. These materials are used to create hemodialysis machines, disposable needles, IV drips, and testing equipment vital to modern medicine. Plastics have also had a considerable impact on developing high-quality prosthetics. The National Medical Device Directorate estimates that Iran's share in the global medical device market will reach well over $7 billion in the next 3 years. PVC materials are also largely used in Iran's construction industry. For example, Iran's Doors and Windows Manufacturers Association estimates the domestic demand for PVC doors and windows is around 35,000 tons annually. This is partly due to the current residential construction boom in the country. The home appliance industry is also another mammoth customer of the polymer industry. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, Iran has doubled its production in this sector over the last 3 years. In 2021, around 15 million home appliance units were produced, with exports soaring to roughly $140 million. So, polymer production is key in expanding many manufacturing industries, which have raked in large amounts of foreign revenue for the country.
Well, I believe it is that time of the show where I should take a little break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. Take it away.
Despite all the advancements in technology and the problems it has solved, food security is one it hasn't. In fact, it is becoming more and more of an issue beyond the countries that have always been grappling with it. One solution is to, end inflation and the global economic crisis, but That's hardly a solution. There's no end in sight with that. But another way is to use technology to make things more efficient. We wouldn't be needing more land because we're not getting it thanks to desertification of more and more land. We also wouldn't be needing more water because we're also not getting it, also thanks to desertification. We would actually need less of both if only we could manage our resources better.
Iran has some potential for farming and agriculture, and that's a massive understatement if you've ever heard one. But we could definitely do with some improvements, some innovations in the field, especially with irrigation, because, well, we've been experiencing some drought and some water shortages a little bit more than what climate change would warrant. And that's why we're here to check out a smart greenhouse that believes has the answer, that the shakeup that the industry needs to be a lot more efficient, especially with water, plus some extra goodies. So stay tuned to this episode of The Bazaar to check out what they've been able to come up with.
About that efficiency, greenhouses can help provide that by creating a controlled environment that, while it could be much smaller than a field, it can yield higher quality produce and more produce per acre. Greenhouses can protect the crops and vegetables from extreme weather conditions, pests, or really any other external threat. The parameters that are controlled in a greenhouse are light, ventilation, humidity, and temperature. This would allow the farmers to create the kind of optimal micro-ecosystem that would eventually lead to them growing healthier, tastier, more nutritious, and, you know, better-looking produce.
What you will find in this smart greenhouse are tomatoes, cherry tomatoes, bell pepper, and cucumbers. There are certain types of fruits and vegetables that are preferred to be used in greenhouses, for example, the ones that I just mentioned. And there are certain types of crops that are not optimal for greenhouse use, for example, wheat and rice. So, but that's just some information about greenhouses in general. What makes this particular greenhouse unique and smart is that all of the parameters that need to be kept in check in a greenhouse are all monitored and manipulated remotely through the cloud and Internet of Things, instead of some worker or some farmers coming in and out of the greenhouse to manipulate things manually. That's the smart aspect of it in a nutshell. But to find out more information about the smartness of this greenhouse, let's hear from some of the experts here.
In this greenhouse, we measure all essential parameters for the plants, like temperature, moisture, CO2, ambient light, the water parameters, and the moisture of the roots, using the available sensors and control them with the actuators and the smart control unit. And also remotely control it via Internet of Things. With properly controlling the climate and the irrigation system, we increase the productivity up to 30% and decrease the water consumption by up to 40% comparing other hydroponic greenhouses in our country. And in the next step, we are trying to recycle the drained water of the irrigation system and pass it through some filters and put it back again into the irrigation system in order to further decrease the water consumption. And also, we are developing a robotic harvester, including a mobile-based manipulator, soft gripper, and vision system equipped with artificial intelligent algorithm in order to detect the ripe crops and pick them in the proper time.
1% of the world's water resources are fresh water, and most of it, in fact, 70% of it, is used in agriculture. What we choose to do with that tiny, finite reserve is a responsibility that we need to bear. Greenhouses can control the irrigation of plants. You may have sophisticated plumbing systems in the ground or in the cocoa peats, as you will see, to prevent overwatering, which can promote rots and fungal diseases, and reduce evaporation, saving huge amounts of water in the process. There is even the option to recycle the runoff water and put it back into the system to further save up on water. The great thing about this particular smart greenhouse is that you don't need to be born into a farmer family that has thousands of acres of land to make this a viable option to you. You can own land as small as 100 square meters and it would still be a financially viable option for you. especially since after the initial installation phase and the setup process, you won't be needing much manpower to control the environment.
Interest has been shown in this smart greenhouse by certain countries, especially in Africa, such as Kenya, Niger, and Ethiopia. The idea, and of course the working proof of the idea, really has the potential to shake up the industry. And if it catches on, it can only mean good things for the farmers and the food sector in general. Thank you for staying tuned to another episode of Bazaar.
Many thanks for that wonderful report. Well, that brings us to the end of our show today. I've been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Political analyst Kutzai Mutosi has said Western aid is used to manipulate Africa. He said the EU gave Zimbabwe money with the aim of influencing the country's recent elections. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote, financial aid given to Zimbabwe by the EU was a tool for influencing and manipulating the country's recent elections. Political analyst Kutzai Mutosi has told RT recently. Mutosi said, the aid which was given by the EU to the Zimbabwean Electoral Commission was not really in good faith. He added, they were using it to manipulate and coerce this Zimbabwean Electoral Commission so that they may achieve their own foreign policy goals. The political analyst stated no one asked them for the money. They brought it voluntarily and with the aim of trying to have some influence on the elections. When that didn't happen, they are throwing a tantrum. Zimbabwe held general elections in August to elect the president and legislators. The incumbent president Emmerson Mnangagwa retained his post by defeating challenger Nelson Chamisa in elections in which allegations of irregularities emerged. The EU announced recently that it will not provide $5 million in financial support to Zimbabwe due to the country's disputed elections, which were criticized for lacking independence and transparency. Mnangagwa criticized covert actions in Africa by Western regimes during his speech at the UN General Assembly in New York recently. He also condemned the use of unilateral and illegal sanctions as a foreign policy tool, citing those imposed on Zimbabwe and Cuba. According to Press TV report, Russia has said it is against foreign interference of any type in African countries in Niger following the recent events in the Sahel state. The Kremlin said potential interference of non-regional powers such as the United States in Niger's domestic affairs was unlikely to help improve the situation. Niger's elite presidential guard seized President Mohamed Bazoum and sequestered him in the presidential palace on July 26. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters recently, "It is unlikely that the intervention of non-regional forces is capable of changing the situation for the better." He said, "Russians were monitoring the situation very closely. We are concerned about the tension in Niger, and we continue to favor a swift return to constitutional normality without endangering human lives." Niger's Western partners and regional allies, including former colonial power France, have imposed sweeping sanctions on the country in an effort to mount international pressure. The ousted president himself has appealed to the international community, the United States in particular, to intervene militarily and restore his presidency. According to Politico, recently, French President Emmanuel Macron has announced that French troops would be withdrawn from Niger in the next couple of months in the wake of the recent events in the Western African country this summer. The military withdrawal from Niger comes after French troops were ousted from neighboring Burkina Faso and Mali. Amid growing anti-French sentiment across the continent and military failures in containing terrorism in the Sahel region. According to French authorities, Macron also said France would imminently withdraw its ambassador, who had been living under effective house arrest in the French embassy in the capital, Niamey. Macron said during an interview with French TV channels, "France has decided to withdraw its ambassador. In the next hours, our ambassador and several diplomats will return to France." He added, Macron also said the military cooperation between France and Niger was over, and that French troops would return before the end of the year. "In the weeks and months to come, we will consult with the putschist because we want this to be done peacefully," he said.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Genocide.
Our people in the Gaza Strip are facing a war of genocide and massacres committed by the Israeli occupation forces in full view of the entire world.
I say frankly to the American statesmen who are now managing the genocide in Palestine,
I am raising alarm about the possibly catastrophic consequences of large-scale ground operations in Gaza and the potential for thousands more civilians to die.
5, 6, 7, 8!
Worldwide, people are condemning Israel and the inability to stop this war.
We're calling for a ceasefire. You know, I want a ceasefire.
We are here to declare our solidarity with Palestine and the Palestinian people.
The streets have spoken. Some ask, what will protests do for Palestinians? For starters, it has changed the mind of many politicians on Israel. Take the UK, which has held large pro-Palestine protests for 3 weeks in a row.
Ceasefire! Now!
The string of resignations have rocked the UK's Labour Party. Came after party leader Keir Starmer said Israel had the right to cut power and water supplies to Palestinians living in Gaza.
And Israel has every right to defend herself.
In the US, pro-Palestinian events have been held across the country. Many Democrats have come out in support of Palestinians over Israel, questioning the US military assistance.
Israel has dropped more bombs in the last 10 days than we dropped in a whole year in Afghanistan.
Let's not forget the Leahy Law, a U.S. human rights law that prohibits the U.S. from providing equipment and training to a foreign entity suspected of committing gross human rights violations. Even some U.N. members are changing their tune, like at the U.N. Condemnations against Israel have come from many European officials. From officials in Spain to EU's Josep Borrell, to Scotland's First Minister Hamza Youssef, who condemned Israel's collective punishment. But the South African Foreign Minister's remarks topped the list.
Why countries like South Africa have been consistent in their support for Palestine and have never deviated from the belief President Mandela held that until the people of Palestine are free, South Africa will not be fully free.
Israel has finally conducted its ground incursions into the Gaza Strip. Apparently, it wants to execute block-by-block warfare. The goal? To destroy Hamas. The human costs will be high. Even Israel has admitted that. The battle will be an extensive one, but there will be a price for that, and we will have a price to pay. But we will go on until we complete this operation to the fullest. This so-called new phase is the second phase out of the three phases that the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs announced a few weeks ago. The first phase, a military bombing campaign. The second, a ground maneuver. And the third, the creation of a new security regime in the Gaza Strip, removing Israel from the responsibility of day-to-day life in the Strip. This third phase raises a lot of questions as to what Gallant meant by a new security regime and the removal of Israel's responsibility for day-to-day life in the Gaza Strip. On the ground operation, Frank McKenzie, retired U.S. Marine four-star general, has said Hamas fighters will seek to draw Israeli forces into a city street fight. He said they will use their tunnel network to get in behind the attack or to attack in all directions to make it very difficult for Israel to effectively employ a technological advantage. Here's a glimpse of the tunnels. They are rather extensive. A complex web, multifunction in scope, and hidden. On Hamas capabilities, this is how Israel was welcomed by Hamas resistance fighters when they entered the Gaza Strip. The shooting of an Israeli armored vehicle with a Kornet ATGM missile in the east of Gaza. Officials and experts are wary that Israel, supposedly having one of the most advanced militaries in the world, with a stockpile of American precision-guided munitions, will get drawn into an urban brawl which it may not handle.
Hamas have a much, much stronger hand, given that they've been building these tunnels over 16 years.
Yeah.
They have been ruling ruling Gaza, and it's a town. They have a town underground that they are in control of, not the Israeli army.
Which brings us to this question. Does Israel even have an end game?
They don't have an end game. They don't have an answer to the crucial question, what will be the day after?
The U.S. does have an end game. Uproot Palestinians, commit another Nakba, sent Palestinians to other countries like Egypt, to the Sinai Desert there. Egypt's reward, U.S. debt to be written off. Meanwhile, Palestinians have another image on their mind.
Since October the 7th, Israel has launched a relentless bombing campaign against the people of Gaza. The bombardments have claimed the lives of thousands of innocent Palestinians, most of them women and children. Israel's genocidal war on the people of Palestine has sparked mass rallies across the world. Journalists, activists, and even athletes have joined the growing calls to put an end to the carnage. But most of these voices are being suppressed due to the pressure by Israel and Zionist lobbies. Reports have been circulating at an alarming pace about activists being sacked from their positions, journalists being relieved of their duties, and even athletes being stripped of their contracts. The editor-in-chief of an academic journal said that he was fired from his job after sharing an article about people dying in Gaza. Michael Eisen, a geneticist at the University of California, Berkeley, and the editor of the scientific journal eLife, tweeted to say that he had been informed that he is being replaced as the publication's editor. Egyptian TikToker Karim Kabani said he had been sacked from his job in France because he made three videos on TikTok in support of the people of Palestine. Jackson Frank, who was recently appointed as the Sixers beat writer for Philly Voice, was relieved of his duties after sending out a tweet in solidarity with the people of Palestine. Frank, a vocal supporter of Palestine, in one of his tweets, days after his unceremonious sacking, termed the Israeli atrocities against the people in Gaza as, quote, genocide. In the Canadian city of Ontario, the New Democratic Party, NDP, expelled MPP Sarah Jama from the caucus earlier this week for her statements in support of Palestinians.
Governments and institutions in Canada are trying to use their voice to wait to silence us, to silence workers, students, educators, and peace-loving people who dare to support Palestine. And to every person who's taking a risk to speak up for Palestinian dignity and safety, I see you and I hear you and I am with you. They try hard to silence us, but we know that our words are powerful, and we must continue to speak up, no matter the cost.
In a series of tweets, Sarah Jama called for an immediate ceasefire and de-escalation. Mahad Akil, one of the top agents in Hollywood, also had to call it quits from her role at the Creative Artists Agency, CAA. After she posted in support of Palestine. And Tanya Singh, a unionist from Minneapolis, said she had been terminated from her job in a union for anti-Semitism over her support for Palestine.
Governments across the world, in an attempt to address anti-Semitism and somehow redress the horrors of the Holocaust, are allowing Israel to get away with apartheid, ethnic cleansing, detention of children, torture, restriction of movement and other freedoms, and the illegal occupation of land. After every genocide, the world cries out, never again. And yet here you see another attempted genocide unfold right in front of your eyes, and you don't just watch on quietly, but actively supporting the oppressor.
Meanwhile, the crisis in Gaza has unveiled Western double standards regarding the issue of Palestinians and their cause. Western nations have tried their best to silence pro-Palestine voices. Germany, for example, has in recent weeks moved hysterically to ban pro-Palestine demonstrations altogether, smearing them as quote-unquote anti-Semitic gatherings. Berlin has violently cracked down on Palestinian activists. French Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin has declared an outright ban on all Palestine-related protests. In addition, those standing in solidarity with the Palestinian cause are also reportedly being stopped,
questioned and fined. In the UK, the Rishi Sunak government has come out openly in support of the Israeli regime's genocidal campaign in the besieged Gaza Strip. Home Secretary Suella Braverman insisted that waving the Palestinian flag could amount to inciting racism or violence. At the same time, Prime Minister Sunak demanded all state buildings should display the Israeli flag. The response by the European officials to the massacre in the Gaza Strip and the subsequent intensifications of the siege and the indiscriminate bombing of civilians by Tel Aviv has laid bare the hypocrisy of the European leaders and their blatant bias towards Israel.
We know for sure that we represent the views of the majority of people in Ireland. We represent the views of our Parliament, and we genuinely believe that we represent the views of the majority of European citizens who have taken to the streets in their tens and hundreds of thousands over the past number of days, appalled by the stance of the EU so-called leaders who have been complicit in genocide and ethnic cleansing by allowing Israel to behave as it does.
Just days ago, more than 800 EU officials wrote a letter to the bloc's chief, Ursula von der Leyen, criticizing her uncontrolled support of Israel. The signatories of the letter said there is a seeming indifference demonstrated over the past few days by our institution towards the ongoing massacre of civilians in the Gaza Strip in disregard for human rights and international humanitarian law. The letter represents deep division within the bloc on how to approach the Israel-Gaza war.
The war in Gaza is in its third week, and Israel has been hinting at a ground operation for several days. Israeli forces, backed by heavy deployment of U.S. warships in the region, have taken positions close to the besieged Strip's frontiers, while at the same time warplanes continue to indiscriminately pound Gaza. The regime, however, keeps delaying the ground invasion, citing the need to enhance the readiness of its forces and the issue of the captives. However, informed sources have told Press TV that Israeli forces have actually tried a ground offensive, and that twice. The first try happened on Sunday afternoon, as an Israeli brigade was ambushed by Palestinian resistance forces when trying to enter Gaza's Rafah border. Two bulldozers and a tank belonging to the regime were hit, and some 10 tanks were left as the Israeli soldiers fled for their lives. The second failed ground invasion, Press TV source said, happened hours later on Sunday night. This time, more than 20 Israeli tanks were repelled on the way to Khan Yunis. The regime's military later reported that one soldier was killed and three were injured by an anti-tank missile shot by Hamas during a raid into the Gaza Strip. The Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, announced later on its Telegram account that it had pushed Israeli forces back into the occupied territories. The next day, Tel Aviv announced that it had decided to delay the ground war in Gaza, pending the arrival of additional American forces in the region. Meanwhile, Hamas and other Palestinian resistance factions have expressed full readiness for any battle on the ground, warning that Gaza will turn into a graveyard for invaders in the event of a ground offensive.
I think this is part of their plan. We are expecting this to happen. But what we hear from the people, from the military wing, that we believe that if they try to enter Gaza again, it will be the, what we call it, the Maqbara, they will be not only defeated, but they will be buried here in the Gaza Strip.
Following the October 7 surprise operation by Hamas, the delusion of Israel's invincible military and intelligence power was shattered. The Al-Aqsa flood operation demonstrated that Hamas and other resistance groups are totally capable of performing offensive operations. On the other hand, resistance movements across the region have warned that in the event of U.S. intervention, all American outposts in West Asia will turn into legitimate targets. The question remains whether Washington is ready to take this dangerous risk or not.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
When the night arrives, Palestinian mothers hold their children close and try to shield them with love. Families gather together in one room so that if they are bombed, they can die together. Nobody will be left to feel sorrow. As the minutes pass, the sky intermittently turns a terrifying red. The explosions bring a malevolent light which reflects onto their homes. They do not know what is happening in places that are out of sight. The state of uncertainty haunts everyone every night. Regarding the situation of Palestinians in Gaza, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "When Gaza is under a major Israeli regime attack, the night is a time of huge fear and anxiety. The effect is suffocating. Once the sun goes down, Gaza transforms into a place where danger has escalated. All Palestinian lives are threatened. Every moment is filled with suffering and apprehension. The night is supposed to cradle them with warmth and love, allowing them to rest after a busy day. When Palestinians are under a major attack, everyone fears the night. At nighttime, the faint glow of the melancholic moon barely pierces through the immense shroud of smoke and dust. The moon's shadows are not comforting any longer. The moon's appearance is associated with the horrors of ruthless aggression. Palestinians used to eagerly await the night. They could indulge in conversations with their siblings. They could gather around with snacks and prepare to watch a movie. But nowadays, when the night arrives, Palestinian mothers hold their children close and try to shield them with love. Families gather together in one room so that if they are bombed, they can die together. Nobody knows if the target is a friend, someone close. Every unfamiliar sound is a potential harbinger of death. Homes tremble as if in an earthquake. Parents try to reassure their children. Don't be afraid, don't be afraid. But how can kids not be afraid when they feel that they might be the target of the next explosion? The sound of ambulances is alarming. It tells you that people have been martyred and others wounded. Children have been turned into orphans. Wives have been turned into widows. There are people missing. There are people trapped under the rubble, waiting to be rescued. A person who is rescued might be the sole survivor in a family. As long as they live, they will bear the scars of the genocide now being committed in Gaza. When a building is bombed, everyone who is not immediately knocked down starts to run, not knowing where to go or where to hide. In the inky blackness, rest is an unattainable dream. Sometimes people fall asleep from the fatigue, maybe in a hospital or a shelter, their eyes filled with tears and dust, and maybe blood. And when dawn finally breaks, it reveals the stark truth of the massive destruction that occurred during the night. The destruction serves as an unrelenting reminder of the Zionist regime's cruelty. How many more nights of terror must people in Gaza endure? How many innocent people must be killed before the Zionist regime feels the thrill of achieving its goals? When will the genocide stop? Regarding the situation of people in Gaza, Palestine Chronicle also wrote, "For about 40 hours, residents of the Gaza Strip were cut off from the rest of the world as the Zionist regime occupation forces severed internet and communication networks throughout the entire strip. The Palestinian Ministry of Health issued a distress call to all the free people of the world, urging them to intervene and restore internet and communications networks. Emergency response crews and civil defense teams were heavily reliant on these networks to respond to rescue and recover those killed and injured by the Zionist regime's missile strikes." Mohammed Al-Hajj, in the communications director at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, said in interview with Palestine Chronicle, "The 40-hour cut in services by the Israeli government resulted in the unnecessary death of many wounded." Al-Hajj added, "We no longer know what is happening in the Gaza Strip. We rely on the ambulance teams for directions to the strike locations, and we redirect ambulance and civil defense vehicles accordingly." Al-Hajj told the Palestine Chronicle that the blackout put citizens' lives at risk and resulted in the loss of many lives due to the delay in the arrival of ambulance and civil defense teams. Jacob Hamad, a volunteer who is assisting in treating the wounded at the Return Hospital in the Nusayrat refugee camp, said that Gaza endured two harsh, dark nights. Experiencing heavy bombardment, the strip was isolated from the rest of the world. Hamad said in an interview with the Palestine Chronicle, "Israeli occupation forces struck Gaza intensively during the past two nights, with the most firepower since the beginning of the Israeli aggression on Gaza. We were waiting for the arrival of the first wounded person to the Return Hospital in the civilian vehicle so we could ask about the location of the airstrikes. We would then mobilize ambulance and civil defense vehicles to the scene. This takes longer and results in the deaths of many wounded. The arrival of the wounded in the civilian vehicles to the hospital and their movement during the airstrikes endangers their lives, but there is no alternative to transporting them in civilian vehicles, which only adds even greater risk and suffering for all the residents of the Gaza Strip." Another Gaza resident, Mahmoud Haroun, told the Palestine Chronicle that Israeli regime forces targeted the entire residential area of the Nusayrat refugee camp, killing more than 15 Palestinians and injuring dozens. Haroon explained that it was impossible to communicate with emergency services and they didn't arrive at the scene until nearly half an hour later. Haroon said, dozens of young people from the neighborhood whom got saved from injury during the shelling volunteered to evacuate the wounded and the martyrs. But the rescue efforts were very weak and we relied on the fires caused by the missiles for visibility because there has been no electricity in Gaza for more than 20 days. Haroon lamented the cries of the children and the wounded at the bombing site were many. And what saddened us the most was our feeling of helplessness in alleviating their suffering. We have no medical equipment and we can't alleviate their pain. Our work was limited to moving the wounded from the bombing site until the ambulances arrived. Abdulrahman Khaled, a young resident of the Nusayrat refugee camp, told the Palestine Chronicle that his good friend, Anas, was killed in an Israeli regime shelling of a residential apartment in the camp after midnight. He didn't find out about his friend's martyrdom until a day after the Zionist regime's bombing, Khaled told the Palestine Chronicle. My friend Anas and all members of his family were buried, and I didn't know that he had been martyred or that his house was targeted by Israeli shelling, because there was no communication and internet for almost 2 days in all of Gaza. Communications have been restored now, giving the survivors time amidst the falling bombs to rescue their wounded and bury their martyrs.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with President Raisi and his cabinet on August 30, 2023, on the occasion of Government Week. Some good things have taken place that have not been conveyed to people in the way it deserves to be. I would like to mention a few of these things so that the facts and realities of the administration will be clearer to the general public and to those who do not have a certain opinion or prejudice. I will speak about them in several sections. In the economic sector, good things have been done by the administration, the details of which were explained to some extent by both the president and the vice president. What I would like to emphasize is that a significant number of macroeconomic indicators signal growth, progress, and positive changes. Of course, it will take some time before the effects of these macroeconomic issues will be seen in people's lives and livelihood. Some administrations tend to sacrifice the future for the present. But this is not what this administration has done. It has done great fundamental work, the effects of which will be seen later, even though they may not be fully apparent today. I will mention a few of the things, but there are also many other things in the report that I have been given. The reports show that there are close to 50 positive things that have taken place in the field of economy. I will share a few of these things with you.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Increased economic growth, especially in the industrial sector, is important. There has been increased growth in investments, which is one of our most important economic issues. Our main problem in some previous periods was the issue of investments, which had a negative growth. It is called negative growth in common terminology, when actually it is not growth, rather it is regression. There has been a reduction in the excessive growth of money supply, which was already mentioned. There has been a reduction in unemployment, a reduction in the Gini coefficient, a significant growth in the export of goods, and a strengthening of tax system. The government's tax revenues have been able to provide a significant part of the government's current budget. There has also been a significant growth in the production of petrochemical products. The issue of petrochemical products is one of the important issues in the country. Valuable measures have been taken in the fields of oil and gas, one of which was phase 11 of the Thous Pars gas field, which was recently inaugurated by the president. Another important activity is the reopening of the closed, partially closed workshops.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Thousands gathered in the Pakistani capital Islamabad for a massive rally in support of Palestine. All Islamic communities, including Shia and Sunni, came together to voice their strong condemnation of Israel's atrocities in Gaza. Pakistan's religio-political party Jamaat-e-Islami hosted Gaza Million March just a few miles away from the U.S. consulate in Islamabad to condemn Washington's role in supporting Israel's crimes.
Israel is brutally attacking the innocent people. Israel is brutally attacking with phosphorus bombs on the hospitals. And every day they kill 500, 600, even 1,000 children and kids and women and civilians. So there is no justification of such a genocide.
Similar rallies were held in other cities where people voiced their anger on what they call the criminal silence of the world on Israeli bombardment in Gaza that has killed thousands of men, women, and children in recent weeks.
Children have nothing to do with war or with hate. This is implantation of hate within children as well, which is a very bad thing for people in the future. I would just say, I would